Today I want to talk about McDowell, a class on mind and world. Is in itself sort of a joke as an idea. It's not clear exactly how you're supposed to cover this book or even the basic ideas of it in anything like that short of frame. What I want to do, I also am sort of aware of the fact that some of you know very little about McDowell and some of you know a lot. And I'd like to try to say some things that could be interesting for both constituencies, and tried to prepare today in a way that might serve that purpose. My aim today really is not to try to fully explain McDowell's ideas, let alone, say, try to defend them, but to simply locate him with respect to the dialectic of the course that we've laid out so far. So, first of all, what I want to be trying to show you is the sense in which the problematic of mind and world has a Kantian structure. Now, in one sense of Kantian, that's a fairly banal and unchallenging claim. I mean, he's quite explicit about his, you know, the shape of his thought bearing some sort of allegiance to Kant. But what I mean by that is more specifically a Kantian problematic in the sense that I've tried to outline it in the previous weeks. More particularly, the sense in which you would be mistaking what's going on in the book if you took the shape of the problematic to be one of a merely Cartesian form. So I'm going to try to bring that out. That's one of my aims for today. Another one of my aims, and I think there's a very common way, or a family of very common ways of misunderstanding McDowell that turn on missing that point, or a point that can be put that way once we have the terminology of Cartesian and Kantian. So so I think this can be helpful for people who are quite familiar with McDowell. A second thing I want to do today, which also I think should be helpful to anyone, is to try to bring out the ambition of the book and the generality of its concern. Something I think that's often missed is that although he does set up the discussion in terms of an issue in philosophy of perception, you will have really, in a quite profound sense, misunderstood this book if you think its concern is merely to make a contribution to the philosophy of perception. That is, the book is working very hard to come up with a characterization of what goes wrong in this area of philosophy of perception that has a certain kind of generality. That's partly why things are formulated in the sometimes seemingly metaphorical, abstract way they are, is to try to get at what he thinks is a fundamental shape of philosophical bind that he thinks pervades contemporary philosophy. And philosophy of perception is just one example of that. So I take it, McDowell, I'm going to be urging that you haven't really understood the book unless you understand that McDowell's concern with a set of issues that he thinks have great scope in philosophy. So there's various asides where he tries to make the connections between these areas of philosophy, and I think they're often sort of missed on many readings. So I'm going to be drawing some attention to one of those to try to help make the more general point. But the general point with respect to how it fits with the class, that this second aspect of what I'm going to be doing today is concerned with, is the following. That McDowell is someone, I take it, who's concerned with the Kantian problematic, but part of what he's concerned with is trying to bring out the overall shape of the Kantian problematic as it occurs across different areas of philosophy. Part of what he's trying to do is get a characterization of it such that one could recognize a recurrence of a problem of that shape, so that one could see that an appropriate diagnosis and treatment of it has to be at a sufficiently fundamental enough level that one's actually treating what he takes to be the root of the problem and not, as it were, merely its symptoms. So there's much concern in mind and world, in a sense, with something like distinguishing the symptoms of certain kinds of philosophical puzzlement or anxiety or difficulty from what is the real underlying problem as he understands it. And much criticism of other people along the lines of, not that I disagree with what they say or they don't have a point, but as a general treatment of this problem, this is much too shallow. And trying to bring out what that kind of difference between McDowell and many people who look upon him as a co-traveler is, I think one can get at that by trying to see the sense in which what he's trying to do is something that put in the vocabulary of the previous classes, we can put this way, trying to bring out the generic character of the Kantian problematic. Now, to do that, in a way, the easiest thing for me to have done, if I wanted to make it easy for myself, would have been to bring out how what he has to say about perception perfectly parallels what he has to say about philosophy of language and rule following. Because that's another case he discusses in some detail in the later lectures in Mind and World, and in much detail in his other writings. So the parallel could be made very, very vivid. But I decided not to do that. What I thought might be more interesting to do is look at one of the places where he draws a connection rather briefly. There are many of these, but look at one of them. And really see how seriously he means it. Because it's by seeing how seriously he means those remarks that one can see what his own understanding is of what he's trying to do in the book. So the case I'm going to look at isn't the third case we had in our opening classes, the philosophy of language case, but the fourth case we had in our opening classes, namely the philosophy of action case, which is one that sort of figures in a lot of McDowell's writings as something he briefly points at. So far, at least, he hasn't written much continuously on philosophy of action, but he means the parallels quite seriously. So I thought that would be an interesting place to go. If there's a sense in which if we can't rehearse what he's saying about philosophy, what he's saying, and apply it to philosophy of action, we haven't really understood it. It seems to be a point that somehow can't come free of his particular treatment of issues in the philosophy of perception, then either we haven't understood McDowell, or McDowell himself is very mistaken about what he's doing. One or the other. So that's the goal today. That's part of the goal today. We'll get on to other things, as you'll see, but that's enough by way of introduction. First, let's just look. I've picked some remarks. The first few quotations, the first three quotations, to be precise, are some remarks from the opening pages, where he's trying to discuss the bind he thinks people get into in philosophy of perception. But I've tried to pick remarks in which he's putting this in fairly generic or abstract terms, and to bring out the point of that, being that the diagnosis is one that's not supposed to apply merely to philosophy of perception. So let's look at these. I've also tried to pick out some stuff that will make the continuity and concern, that, in my view, non-accidental continuity and concern between McDowell's topic in the opening chapters of this book and what we were talking about two classes ago in Lewis, very explicit. So in the first quotation, he's talking about empirical thinking. And there's a thought, which we had in Lewis, that if we're going to make sense of our cognitive capacities, our thinking has to be active. It involves construction, involves interpretation, involves something we bring to experience. The word that McDowell hits particularly to make this point, an equally Kantian word, is freedom. That there has to be, in that sense, an element of freedom in any cognitive activity. So initially, the topic of this first quotation is the freedom in empirical thinking. And so there's this point that you have in Kant, which is that all cognition seems to involve an element of spontaneity. You could put it in a kind of more banal sort of contemporary philosophy of science way, or philosophy of language way, by saying, you know, any description of the world involves concepts, and concepts involve a choice of concepts. There isn't anything which is the privileged system of concepts. And so some moment of choice, or some at least arbitrary element of selection, seems required in the apparatus we bring to our description of the world. So freedom, this moment looks in one sense necessary, but this point can also seem to threaten a start about empirical thinking, and as we saw in Lewis, specifically a story about perceptual knowledge. If the freedom is total, is the way McDowell puts it in the first clause of your first quotation, the way Lewis put this is if our concepts are not constrained by anything outside the sphere conceptual activity, if it's total, it's not constrained from outside the conceptual sphere. That could be that clause is almost lifted from Lewis. I don't mean he's read Lewis and lifted it. I meant if you're in the Kantian problematic, you find yourself saying things like this. That can seem to threaten the very possibility that judgments of experience might be grounded in a way that relates them to a reality external to thought. So we need this moment of freedom, spontaneity, activity, concepts that are ours. However you want to put this. I pick McDowell's word for the moment. We've seen other ways of putting this. On the other hand, we need external constraint. This is a very abstract way of putting the desiderata. We need something that makes these concepts the right concepts to use, and something that makes a judgment or a description about how things are thus formulated a true one rather than a false one. Not just a game in which we're playing with those concepts. So where do we get external constraint from? So there's a threat. The initial threat. First, you know, there's an empiricist picture in which you see that knowledge involves the senses or passivity. And there's a problem. That doesn't seem to add up to a story about knowledge. That just seems to add up to a story in which objects are sort of stamping themselves on our senses. You know, the equivalent of a punch in the nose, sensorily speaking. And, you know, this doesn't have any particular representational content any more than something impinging on my senses does. So it looks like we need something more. So we say freedom. But if we identify the concepts we have exclusively with this moment of freedom in which we bring the concepts to bear without what the senses supply constraining in some way, then it seems like we have a kind of unbounded freedom which comes down to a kind of emptiness. So we say, no external strength. The external restraint must ground, justify, select, have at least, to put it very minimally, have a bearing on which concepts we choose when and why. Looks like there seems to be some relation of bearing here. Lewis, as you recall, talked more specifically of guidance at this point. We need that if what we have over here, when we have the moment of freedom, which is supposed to be a story about empirical judgment, I tend for the American spelling. Dowell tends for the English spelling. I don't care which. Your spell check might, depending upon which branch of Microsoft produced it. The thought is, without external constraint, this isn't recognizably a story of empirical judgment at all. Says McDowell. So, we need external constraint. So this is the beginning of a problem. Then the problem is, when we try to have a story about external constraint, how do we tell the story? Well, initial way of telling the story is to say, well, the external constraint comes in the form of what we sense. What do we sense? Well, we could say something like, sensory impressions. I have an impression of a chair. And then what quickly came to be the problem, as we saw Lewis insisting, so it looks like you can't even have that without a concept. You can have a sensation. The sensation might, you know, involve some particular wavelength. But that doesn't involve something that has the shape of a claim. X is phi. This is a chair. Or this is red, to take a concept that might seem even somehow possible to buy even more cheaply. That concept itself has boundaries of application that, at least in English, exclude, for instance, orange, though it shades quite naturally into orange. Excludes brown, though it shades into it. So impressions don't look like they can just be of something. If that's what comes externally without concepts, is just impressions that are conceptually unstructured, if that's what the given is, then it's hard to see how the given can play a warranting or grounding or guiding or constraining function. That's already coming up in quotation two. The idea of the given is the idea that the space of reasons, the space of justifications or warrants, extends more widely than the conceptual sphere, McDowell says. Now, actually, I think what he should have said here, and I think later things he wrote suggest he'd be happy with this amendment. What he should have said here, I think, is the mythical idea, or the mythical conception of the given, is one according to which, I think the capitalizing is partly meant to bring out that it's not just, you know, an idea of external. He's not trying to throw out the idea of external constraint. The given is that which constrains externally, then. The point isn't to throw that out. But there's a particular idea of it, capitalized, the thing that Sellars was trying to criticize off of the discussion in chapter 1. And his particular way of putting that here. And one thing I want to show you is how carefully he's actually put this. And part of the reason why. This is a point at which McDowell is often already misunderstood. So, perfect example of someone who I think misunderstands him is his colleague Robert Brandon, who has been talking to him in the same philosophy department with offices next door to each other for 18 years. So, it gives you some idea of, in fact, there's something slippery here. I'm sorry I don't have this on your... And I didn't have this book. I borrowed it from Richard just before class, but it seems to be a nice way of making the point about the specificity of how McDowell's putting things in quotation too. So this is Empiricism, Philosophy in the Mind, Sellars' book, his essay, reprinted as a book, with a study guide by Brandom. I suppose one sort of implicit point I'm making here, which I don't have much time to elaborate, is don't believe the study guide. That is, the study guide isn't a very good guide to Sellars. It's an excellent guide to Branham's thought, I think. But right now, we just want to ask, so what is the given, or what is the myth of the given? Branham says, the myth of the given is the idea there can be a kind of awareness that has two properties. First, that it's a kind of knowledge. It's a kind of state that can be right or wrong. It's a state that you're in simply in virtue of, that you possess simply in virtue of being in it, that knowledge. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this capacity to have this kind of awareness, being a state of knowledge, is something that doesn't presuppose any concepts. That's the myth. It's a kind of knowledge, can be right or wrong, can have the kind of vulnerability that X is phi has to these circumstances. This is a chair, this is red. But you can be in that state simply by exercising unacquired capacity. You don't need to acquire a concept. Say simply, maybe in virtue of your capacity to sense. That would be one story of the given. So he's trying to give it some generality. If you have the way Branham's put it, it's a little more general than that. If you think, for instance, having an innate idea implanted into you somehow, without having to learn any language, or to have any acquired capacities kick in, is a way of being in that state, that would still be a version of the given for him. So he's put it with some generality. And I actually think that gloss on the idea of a certain mythical conception of the given fits section one of Empiricism, Philosophy of Mind pretty well. That is, if you read only 1/16th of the way into the essay, then actually the study guide's doing fine. I think the study guide is already, it's still in part one. But the thing about Brandom, as you'll see, is that he identifies the myth of the given with that particular version of it. Whereas I think it's exactly what Sellars isn't doing. He's saying, this is a rather superficial guide, sense datum theories. And then he continues to deepen the characterization. But what I'm interested in now is Brandom goes on to put that same point in a number of different ways, by pointing at various people. One thing he does is he quotes McDowell in the footnote. He said, as McDowell puts the point, and we get a quotation from McDowell. Look at that in a minute. He also goes on to... Sellars, and says that Sellars' crucial argument is that these two features, being the state of knowledge that can be correct or incorrect, and it's being unacquired, these two features are incompatible. That's Sellars' critical point, he says. So he takes that to exhaust the attack. And then he also cites Davidson. Davidson expresses another version of this thought with the slogan, nothing can count as a reason for holding a belief except another belief. So his thought is, nothing unacquired can play this role, so merely acquired stuff does. To fall into the myth of the given is not to agree with Davidson at this point. So Brandom is setting a big equal sign between all of these things. Now that is going to be misunderstanding McDowell in about five ways at once. But let's just mention a couple of them. One misunderstanding is, we'll see that although one of McDowell's targets here is the myth of the given, Another one of his targets is a kind of coherentism that he associates. He associates in this chapter with Davidson and Sellars. That's a mistake about Sellars, I think. I can come back to that. It's a scholarly footnote. But certainly Davidson and Branham would have done fine. He says he's reading Sellars at this point still through Branham's spectacles. He's taking Branham's word for about who Sellars is, up to a point at least. Whereas McDowell wants to see those two views as pitted against each other and to take a different path. Branham saying the only way to avoid the given is to hold Davidson's view. The myth of the given, rejecting the myth of the given and agreeing with Davidson are the same point philosophically for Branham. He's sort of closed the space. That's the less interesting. That's such a fundamental misunderstanding of McDowell, in a way. It's not even interesting. I mean, that really misses everything in McDowell. But the more fundamental misunderstanding of McDowell is to merely identify the myth of the given with something like the kind of view he has here, thinking you could have concepts, or you could have something which requires concepts, like an articulated state of knowledge that has those sorts of normative conditions of correctness and incorrectness, that you could have that simply in virtue of an unacquired capacity, like your senses. If that's all there was to the myth of the given, then think back to Lewis. Lewis would be one of the great enemies of the myth. Lewis's point, as we saw in that chapter you read, is the given by itself doesn't even figure in our awareness. Not only couldn't it be true or false, but you never even just have an element of the given. In order for something to be a cognitive state, it must be conceptually structured in some way. One of the things it must be, for instance, is shareable, which already requires concepts and language, he thinks. And conversely, he thinks that, you know, Lewis thinks, this is where he's disagreeing with Brandon, that just having concepts by itself wouldn't give you very much, unless they were somehow constrained by the given. So, Lewis is a critic of the myth of the given, explaining the way Branham explains it. But then Branham has his footnote. He says, as McDowell puts the point, which he takes to be the same thing. Here's how McDowell puts the point. The idea of the given is the idea that the space of reasons, we're on quotation 2 of your handout also. So I'm reading McDowell. He's quoting, maybe Branham's quoting McDowell, quoting your handout. The idea of the given is the idea that the space of reasons, the space of justifications or warrants, extends more widely than the conceptual sphere. This way of putting it does make contact with Lewis. What Lewis wants to say is, yes, what we ordinarily call justification, that requires concepts. Any state of consciousness requires concepts. Anything we ordinarily call knowledge, that requires concepts. But Lewis's worry was, but we still need, and here's part of the difference between McDowell and Branham, or McDowell and Davidson. McDowell's taking this worry that Lewis has seriously. We need some kind of external constraint. But Lewis then thinks, well, you can't get that external constraint unless there's some sort of relation of guidance from the realm of our natural capacities. Let's call them natural capacities, where this, for Lewis, does mean something like capacities we have ab initio, without any sort of bildung being required. It's an unacquired capacity. We need some sort of constraint that's applied on our conceptual capacities. The exercise of these must be constrained by those where neither limits the other. That was that quotation I emphasized in Lewis, where this is really independent of that. This bears on that from the outside. So this idea that there must be something that constrains the conceptual sphere from the outside, that's exactly the way McDowell talks. That perfectly captures Lewis's picture. And then you saw how hard it was for Lewis to tell a story. And Lewis himself knew it was hard. He wanted a story about qualia. He wanted a story about something that had the kind of generality you need to have something built into it so it can play a guiding function. No particular can do that. And yet he wanted the kind of generality, universality that attaches to these things to be of a generically different sort than falling under a concept. Because then he'd realize he's just slipping back in the concepts. The guidance of which is supposed to constitute their acquisition. So he's trying to avoid that circle. So that difficulty that Lewis had, which McDowell thinks anyone's going to have who thinks hard about this, is exactly the kind of view that McDowell's trying to capture by putting this in a very different way than Brandom does. So one difference is he's taking this worry seriously. The second is that he's trying to come up with a characterization of the myth of the given that then captures all sorts of different views that are trying to hang on to this demand in a way that he thinks won't work, not just the particular way that Brandom has in view. Just a little historical footnote might be in order here. I think that if you read later things by McDowell, you'll see his reading of Sellars has changed a lot. He stopped taking Brandom's word for who Sellars is. So Sellars, too, is attached to much more careful and fundamental ways of putting what the myth of the given is than the one that Brandom relies upon in basing his characterization in the opening of the Sellars essay. And in particular, Sellars is interested in criticizing Lewis. That is, the way Sellars puts the myth, he never puts it in McDowell's way, but a way Sellars puts it is to say something like, the very idea that we could have repeatable sense determinables, the very idea that we could have something that has the character of something that can be further determined, that has conditions of correctness or incorrectness, but itself does not presuppose concepts, is a mistake. Another way to put this is the very idea that we could be possessed of something you might call sensory classificatory consciousness, a consciousness which can classify things in ways that something counts as having classified it correctly or incorrectly. Or another way of putting it is the idea that you could have a consciousness that looks in the world and recognizes something as the same again, where there's a determinate content to that achievement of recognition. So you could later say, it could say to itself, I made a mistake. It isn't the same again. Not just that it was surprised or frustrated, and it started going, because the food wasn't there. But it actually had a grasp of what it had committed itself to in holding the one state of consciousness, such that he could see the other state of consciousness had falsified that commitment. The building in of that kind of structure into what happens in perception is already presupposing, Sellars thinks, something that only comes with languages. It's taking a kind of structure that comes as we learn language and concepts and projecting it back to a stage of cognizance or sentience or percipience that doesn't yet and couldn't yet have it. But Sellars himself thinks, but we need external constraint. Sellars himself is a student of Lewis and shares this. I'm talking about the real Sellars now, not the one that's discussed in the first chapter of Mind and World, who's lumped together with Davidson, but the real Sellars. He shares this worry. So Sellars, actually like Lewis, is trying to tell a story about how sensations can guide our use of concepts without falling to the myth of the given. And his story gets really complicated. It involves something called picturing, for instance. She's an elaborate story, inspired by the Tractatus. You'll never see Brandom talk about it anywhere when he writes about Sellars, even though Sellars writes about it a lot. But what's interesting is that McDowell's way, already in Mind and World, of putting the myth in the given, what he thinks is the fundamental myth, also places Sellars in the target range. Because this is still an attempt to constrain the conceptual sphere, in some sense normatively, from the outside. So when McDowell says, the idea of the given is the idea of the space of reasons, or justifications, or warrants, or constraints, or things that can introduce guidance, things that can give you a clue, or a sign, or an indication of which concept to apply. That extends more widely than the conceptual sphere. That's this fundamental way of putting the idea of the given. And that is a very careful formulation of what the myth is at the bottom level, which even once he reads Sellars and sees Sellars as having a very different view, he doesn't need to change. Sellars still falls into his target range. Sellars will still count as someone who, if he fully understood the myth of the given, has fallen into it for McDowell. Now, again, this is put extremely generically, so that he means to be capturing a point about philosophy of perception here. But as I'll try to show you, the point, importantly, extends from beyond philosophy of perception. So the next sentence is, the extra extent of the space of reasons is supposed to allow it to incorporate non-conceptual impacts from outside the realm of thought. So thong is, whatever provides this external constraint, if we're doing philosophy of senses, that belongs to the senses and is due to a kind of structure or character they have as part of nature, that they have anyways, as nature is in itself. There's a certain conception of the natural world. There's a conception of the senses as part of the natural world. And we need to build up a story about what secures external constraint out of ingredients so conceived. Here, non-conceptual impacts, the impacts so involves. I thought about this being philosophy of perception or impinging on mind or in senses. And then he said, then I just quote something that he's summarizing, he's already tried to argue in the previous pages, and here he himself is building on Sellars. The thought is, anything conceived in those terms, if external constraint is conceived of as belonging to the realm of nature, so conceived. So I gave you a particular gloss on how to understand what falls into the realm of nature as it is in itself. And it's not an accident. A lot of people miss this, but if you see what McDowell's doing, it's not an accident that that's the notion he's trying to challenge in this book. A lot of people think it's sort of afterthought. He needs to say more. They sort of fail to see from the beginning that a certain assumption about what the character of that which must provide external constraint is has come into play here, and that has to be his target. That something that falls into nature thus conceived, a mere physical happening, whether the physical happening be between two billiard balls or a billiard ball hitting my optic nerve, or you know some other part of my nervously sensitive, merely physical body, an event of that sort cannot constrain normatively. That to have that kind of constraint, you need a concept. It might be, for instance, that if you have an automatic door opener, so that if I step here, the door opens. Some supermarkets in America have this, somewhere in Norway. Automatic door opener. There's a causal hookup here. I step, door opens. You can hook things up so that you have that kind of reliable, differential, responsive disposition built into the door and the floor mat before it, thinking of those as one coordinated unit. But in order to have something happen that's true or false, like for instance, what might happen is if I'm sort of down the hallway, I'm sure there's some Clint Eastwood film where something like this happens, and this door suddenly opens. Clint knows there's a person standing here. And I'll be very decisive for this person, eventually meeting one of Clint's bullets. But the thought, there's a person there, that can't be put in place simply in virtue of this hookup. That involves the concepts, a number of rather complicated concepts, but actually involves indexicals, it involves picking things out in space, it involves the concept of a person. If you change it, you think that's the wrong thing, you want to say, there's a something there that weighs more than so-and-so pounds. That doesn't change the point. You just substitute one set of concepts for another. The door opener is not in a position where it's got some view of the world, where it's true or false. We could change the hookup so it just opens without a person being there. And we haven't suddenly led the door opener to have all sorts of false beliefs. So in order to actually have something which has that kind of sensitivity, the kind of sensitivity such that there can be that kind of accord or lack of accord between the sensory state, aha, there's a person there. That can't be a result merely of something impinging on us. That impingement, however we understand it, is going to have some further structure. It can't just be A causes B in the merely efficient natural law sense of causation that belongs to this picture. That's the claim that he's relying on, which he's taking from Sellars. So, external constraint, so conceived, cannot impinge on the conceptual realm. It can't tell us which concepts to use and which not. Or to put the point a little more broadly, as Davidson and Brandon do, it cannot offer any element of justification. What Brandon and Davidson conclude from that, and they're sort of stand-in targets for another possible view here in McDowell, although he has Sellars, I say that's wrong, so I say Brandon and Davidson rather than Sellars. What they conclude is, well, the only thing that can justify a belief or some structured set of concepts putting forward a claim is another one of those, another belief, or another string of concepts structured so as to form a claim. So justification on this story is, as it were, imminent to this sphere of concepts understood purely as exercises of freedom, understood as things initially that don't have any empirical content. And then you got to tell some story, otherwise it looks very satisfying, about how this causal hookup makes some sort of difference somebody should care about. But you still have a story in which whatever it's doing, it's never justifying. And Brandon, in particular, I think, has a heroically complicated story where he tries to make this matter, even though he concedes the point that external constraints, so conceived, could never justify anything. So they take that conclusion to mean all justification must be imminent to the sphere of beliefs. Experience cannot justify. Brandon even goes further and says, experience isn't even one of my words. I'm very proud it's not in the index of making it explicit. I don't really use it. It's just a name for a bad idea. Experience is something that somehow through perceiving could bear on our beliefs. He just wants to throw that out. Very radical response. But the radicality of the response comes from something philosophically percipient, namely realizing how deep this problem is. Now, so you get another view, the coherentism view, by saying this story of the given always winds up filling this arrow with something that's empty or confused. So we need to erase the arrow here, at least as far as there being any normative relation. We can allow for some kind of causal relation, because of course things in the realm of nature so conceived can cause things to happen. That's not a problem. Including causing things to happen to us as physical and material beings. But all our justificatory arrows have to be drawn in this circle. But that just throws us back into the worry of quotation one. That throws us back into, that threatens the very possibility that judgments of experience might be ground in a way that relates them to a reality external to thought. That's exactly what Lewis is worried about when he says, but then our thoughts aren't true to anything. We must have external constraint. So we're back to going, uh-oh, better draw an arrow. Or, as McDowell puts it in quotation 3, it can be difficult to accept that the myth of the given is a myth. It can seem as if we reject the given. We merely reopen ourselves to the threat of the idea that the given is a response to, the threat that our picture does not accommodate any external constraint on our activity of thought and judgment, etc. So we come under pressure, end of the quotation, to recoil back into appealing to the given. And then he thinks if we think it through again, and maybe in the slightly deeper version of Qualia or whatever, it's only to see all over again that it cannot help. Last sentence of the third quotation. There is a danger of falling into an interminable oscillation. So McDowell wants to diagnose certain exchanges that happen in the history of philosophy as one in which you can see people going back and forth between the option of trying to draw this constraint external to the sphere of conceptual activity. That very general way of putting it makes any version of that a myth of the given. So if you have this circle and an arrow between them, external to the sphere of activity, any version of that, he's saying, won't work. And any solution to that, which just erases the arrow and says all justification therefore happens merely within a sphere of conceptual activity that is not normatively constrained from without, raises the other problem, which is just as deep. And so he's trying to give a level of characterization where neither of those views can work. Many things are versions of both of those views. And you can see the many things that come up as reactions to each other, so that there is what he calls a seesaw effect. A seesaw is a thing like this, where this guy stands here, it goes like that. If this guy stands there, it goes like that. Yeah. And something like that, he thinks, is happening. Yes, Michael, do you have a question?
I think these two concepts here, you show now, the one with the arrow and the without arrow, they are both linear. They're kind of linear. And I think that the whole claim is kind of an approach to a dialectic form of thinking, if I might use this word. Kind of balancing, like the thing you were thinking on the
I think McDowell might be sympathetic to that. But what I want to do right now, actually, is not... what I'm trying to do right now is I'm moving again, maybe frustratingly slowly for you, but I'm not even going to try to say what's wrong with this at the moment, or even yet what McDowell thinks is wrong with this in any deep way. But what I want to do is give a story about philosophy of perception. And what I want to do next is just, as a level of description, bring out how general it is. That is, how it doesn't just hold in perception. So that would make us interested in a way of putting your solution, if it is a solution, so it can spread with that generality. But conscious of the fact that Scotland and Norway are about to play each other, maybe we should take a 10-minute break.